Hello, I'm Martijn Gaat and this is Does Logistics Matter? A podcast on trends and innovations in supply chain and logistics. Answering yes to the question today is Jason Anderson, Senior Program Director at the Climate Works Foundation. In this episode, we talk about the current state of decarbonization in the shipping industry, how we can bring down the carbon footprint of ocean freight, what that will take from shippers, shipping companies, ports and governments, and what innovations and technology will help us reach a zero-emission shipping industry. Please enjoy my conversation with Jason Anderson. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Martin. Great to be here.
The first question of this podcast is always the same, and that question is, does logistics matter?
Well, I think you'd be surprised if you invited somebody who said no. So I'm going to say yes, but not only for that reason. We really do think that logistics matters.
Okay. So what's your link to logistics? Because you don't work in the logistics industry.
No. So I work at ClimateWorks Foundation. We are a philanthropic organization that supports nonprofits who are working to decarbonize the maritime shipping industry. And of course, maritime shipping is hugely important in logistics, seeing as between 80 to 90% of all of our goods that are traded around the world at some point are on a ship.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I think if I have the number correct, the shipping industry is responsible for 3 or 4% of the total carbon footprint.
It's around 3%, in the grand scheme of things doesn't seem like a lot. But on the other hand, that's the same as a major country like Germany or Japan.
Yeah.
You know, it's about 1 billion tons of carbon dioxide a year, which is similar to all of the coal-fired power plants here in the United States. So it is quite significant.
Yeah, no, it's huge. I mean, it's 3% of a very, very, very large number. So that makes it significant. How you look at it? What's the current state of the sustainability level of ocean shipping?
We like to think of how we're going to progress to eventually having a zero carbon sector with the concept of an S-curve of technology diffusion. This is common for a lot of sectors that have gone through transformations. Mm-hmm. You start very low, you ramp up quickly, eventually you level out at 100% adoption of a new technology. And honestly, we're way on that left-hand side of the curve. There's really not a lot of zero carbon shipping out in the world, particularly in the large ocean-going vessels.
Yeah.
But we're optimistic that we will be able to get there precisely because that's kind of the transformation that you do see sectors going through, whether or not it's for low carbon technologies or other things. And that's kind of the journey we're on with maritime shipping.
Yeah, and what I see in the news is there are an increasing number of ships that are using more sustainable fuels. Let's talk about ammonia, methanol. There are, as far as you can say, greener versions of bunker fuel, which is, I guess, as black as you can get. I've heard about ships even using sails again to navigate the oceans. What do you see?
Yeah, it is interesting. We're talking about decarbonizing a sector that originally was a zero carbon sector. We're kind of coming full circle in a way because vessels indeed used to run entirely on sail. And we went through this period of going through the different types of fossil energy to propel ships, just essentially so that they could be more regular in the routes and you'd be reliable in the timing that you could count on, not counting on the wind. But in fact, we're in a completely different period of technological development where things like sails can really cut your fuel requirements. So that's assisting ships right now. We have big ships that are able to essentially bolt on things called Flettner rotors right on deck. And there are other concepts. And so there are a lot of what are effectively efficiency improvements, both in the physical characteristics of the ship, whether that's hull coatings or types of propellers and so forth, that cut the amount of energy they use. They save fuel, therefore, of course, carbon emissions. But there's a limit to how far you can take that. Also, operationally, you can slow down, which is really the easiest way of saving fuel. But at a certain point, you need to go to a different propulsion technology. You need to go to some other kind of fuel. Right now, heavy fuel oil, marine diesel, these are massively polluting. I mean, they emit far more sulfur, even with the recent 2020 rules that limit the amount of sulfur you're allowed to use. It's still much more than you'd have in a car, for example. And of course, they emit carbon dioxide. So the kinds of alternatives really depend on how big the ship is and how far it's going. So if you're in a harbor, if you have tugboats or you have ferries, then you can actually electrify those. That's a direction that a lot of places are going. And that's by far the most efficient way you can use green energy, is to use it in the form of electricity, because you don't have to transform it to something else. But the problem with large ocean-going vessels is they have so far to go. They're fighting against waves and wind, et cetera, these giant vessels. So they do need some other form of fuel that's like a liquid fuel. So that means at the moment, there are companies like Maersk, for example, that have ordered methanol ships. And the trick here is that there's different ways of making alternative fuels. You can do it in a green manner, where you're actually creating green hydrogen. You are, potentially capturing carbon from the air and then converting that to methanol. But that's not what's happening right now. They're using biological origin carbon, which has its question marks. And you can also use hydrogen directly, although it's not very energy dense. So it depends, again, how much room you're willing to take up from your potential cargo space to put the new tanks in. Ammonia is actually thought of as probably the long-term solution, because it's more energy dense than hydrogen. It can be made directly from nitrogen captured from the air and hydrogen converted from water using renewable electricity. So that's kind of where companies see us heading. It's just that they haven't really built many of those ships yet. The engine technologies are just at the point of commercialization. So there are several, being constructed at the moment.
And so you were saying something, I think it was about the methanol, and it made me think of how in some areas in the Netherlands, electric trucks are charged, because in some areas in the Netherlands, the grid is just full. There's just no more, there's no more power to give. It's maxed out. And I've heard of instances where sometimes trucking companies are actually charging their trucks with diesel generators. So then you're using diesel to charge your zero emission vehicle. Is that similar?
Well, I guess you'd have to say that there are teething troubles in any sectoral transformation. And ideally, in the Netherlands and elsewhere, you would have an electrical grid that's able to sustain the kind of transformation to electric transport that we're looking to see. There's always these questions of, do you wait for the perfectly built out, decarbonized electric grid before you put the trucks on them? Or do you try to develop the trucks themselves and that supply chain and infrastructure, and then kind of match it with the properly functioning grid over time? For a little while, you're going to have a less than ideal situation. And I think we're kind of in that space with shipping now, where particularly things like methanol and these early experiments in zero carbon shipping, will there be some fossil origin, so-called zero carbon fuels, which are only at the point of emission, not in the production zero carbon? Will we have some of that?
Yeah.
Really, I mean, for us, we're not counting that as zero carbon, and we're certainly advocating against it, but it will creep in, no doubt. I think the bigger question is around, to what degree can you use biofuels as a transition? To what degree do we see things like blue ammonia, where you use fossil gas, but you might capture the carbon in that process. There are a number of options out there, but I think the thing that people need to understand is the price of renewable electricity is dropping dramatically. So actually making green electrons over time is going to get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, to the point where making a hydrogen and a hydrogen derived fuel ultimately should be the cheapest option. So it's more like a kind of transition period we're in right now.
Yeah, and I think I heard this when I was talking to somebody about this yesterday. They were talking about, they were calling it transitional fuels. So it's, you know, it's not ideal, but it's better than what we had, and it's being used to learn and to develop the end product that will be zero emission.
Yeah, the zero carbon fuels that we're looking to see, but there are, of course, these. There's always question marks about what you count as part of the transition. I mean, the thing we're really fighting against is the use of liquefied natural gas, LNG, because it doesn't give you that problem of sulfur emissions, which are particulates that cause respiratory problems, kills people, tens of thousands of people from marine diesel fuel every year. So that's a plus, but it really offers very little, if any, greenhouse gas benefit, particularly because methane is released right through the entire cycle of from the well, as they say, to the wake. So well to wake,
yes,
you have
well to
big
wake
emissions of carbon through LNG. And unfortunately, a lot of countries, a lot of companies have been investing in that as a so-called transition. But, you know, if you've spent all your money on the infrastructure for one technology, you're unlikely to turn around and do it again for something else. So we want to put the brakes on that so that we've got what it takes to be able to invest where what a long-term solution would be.
No. So you've mentioned several of the new fuel types that we have, or propulsion systems. Are there other technologies that come into play?
Well, there are a range of things that go, as I say, from efficiency, and that's where we need to start right now, both technical efficiency and operational efficiency. And I think people are when we talk about a long-term transformation of a sector, they almost tend to overlook the obvious in some ways. And that's where that is. These are methodologies and technologies that we can implement right now and should actually be able to get us through the next decade along this curve of the decarbonization trajectory we want to be on, without necessarily really needing much in the way of new fuels. So we're kind of developing those fuels in the background while we're doing these efficiency changes. And sales, as we mentioned earlier, they seem from the outside like a no-brainer. Here you've got this free energy just, you know, flowing all around your ship that you can capture. You know, there's some hesitancy in the industry that to some degree just has to do with the habits of where they've been and the technologies they've been employing. So it is a switch in mindset as much as anything in order to take advantage of those types of technologies. And of course, you know, in a logistics podcast, it's no surprise that the kind of routes that your ships run on, really trying to optimize. One of the things that happens in shipping right now is, because of the nature of the contracts, you get charged for essentially being late. So what ships will do is they'll rush across the ocean to make sure that they're at the port on time, but then there's a backup at the port and you sit there with your engines churning and these emissions going out, not just of carbon dioxide, but particulates. And of course, you're near the port, so you're near population centers. And that's what that's what causes that pollution. Lots of basins around port cities are just absolutely choked with ship pollution, which a lot of people don't realize. They see the cars, they see the trucks. But in fact, in a lot of places, it's really the ships that are causing most of the air pollution they're seeing.
Okay. Because it's not only the ships moving across the oceans, it's also and it's not only the power that the ships do, well, not that the ships need to propel themselves forward. So there's also a lot we can do, I guess, on land to make sure that when ships get near land, that we can maybe provide power to them in such a way that they don't have to use their engines.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this again seems like dead obvious, that if you've got a ship at birth that you can plug in and run all of the auxiliary systems on board. And so it's much better to plug in. And a lot of places around the world have been doing this form of cold ironing. But, you know, there's always these questions. Okay, you have to spend a lot of money as a port to be able to put that electrical system in. And then you have to spend some money on the ship to convert it. And so the question is, well, what gets required of whom? Just offering it might not actually, you know, result in, I mean, among other things, ship fuel isn't taxed and electricity is taxed. So what's the actual price differential? Yeah. There's some policy questions around incentivizing it as well.
Yeah. Who's going to pay? I guess in any logistics operation is always the question, because a lot of the parties involved have very low margins. So they, if a type of fuel is more expensive, then, you know, somebody needs to pay for it.
Yeah, I mean, and you've put your finger on the main question of this entire transition, which is who pays and how much. So if you look at a container ship that is transporting a wide range of goods, tends to be fairly high value compared to, let's say, dry bulk shipping or whatever, you can go down to like the individual, the classic example is if you have some shoes, the price of a pair of shoes might rise from $150 to $151 if you were to decarbonize the shipping fuel. So the consumer is not likely to really see that. So from that perspective, it's a fairly cheap transition. But when you look at the actual cost of the fuel itself at the moment, even though, as I say, we're quite early, so we don't really have a lot of examples to point to. But if you try to procure zero carbon fuel right now, it's multiples of the price of what you would pay for diesel fuel. And the industry all around that question is asking, well, wait a minute, will I invest in producing this fuel? Like, will anybody want to buy it from me? And then, you know, the shipbuilders are saying, will anybody procure a ship for me that will burn this fuel? And then the cargo owners are saying, well, I'm kind of interested in, you know, having an environmental profile, so I'll put a certain amount of cargo on these. And everybody's looking at each other saying, well, wait a minute, where's the demand coming from? Who's paying for what? You know, so that's a complicated picture to try to resolve when you're just getting the ball rolling.
Yeah, so we have multiple chickens and multiple eggs, even.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I guess where we can also change is mindset. Just, you know, try to organize our supply chains in such a way that we need a little bit less shipping. I know that there's this one of these pictures that has been I've seen that shared on LinkedIn. I thought it was some sort of fruit which was grown in South America, then put on a ship, and then brought to somewhere in Europe. There it was processed. Then it was brought to China for some sort of packaging. And then it was sent somewhere else to be sold. And if we're doing things like that, then we're just adding mile on mile on mile. And that doesn't make sense either.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of thing, it's enough to drive you crazy if you think about the miles involved in producing such a simple product. And really, it just tells you that it's cheap. Otherwise, it wouldn't be done that way. So when we get the objection that something is too expensive, you say, well, you know, if you're able to do that, then clearly not enough is being charged, because the environmental externalities of all that movement are being borne by people who are facing the air pollution, the eventual climate change impacts. So already we have a system where we are not pricing the cost of that kind of impact into, as I say, untaxed ship fuel. We have no carbon levy or tax. And that's one of the things the International Maritime Organization, the IMO, will be looking at, and hopefully will have an impact there. But, you know, there are more complicated aspects to the way that the industry is organized. We've had this trend over the past couple of decades of ships getting bigger and bigger. And so, you know, it from the perspective of the shipping company that is able to maximize the returns to scale from having a massive ship, it looks great. But if you're the port that suddenly has to expand its operations, dredge a channel, spend a ton of money to be able to accommodate these new ships, if they're so big that they unload in one go back out and come back in to reload, it actually causes a lot of logistics problems for lots of places, including in the hinterland, which you have to be able to get these things off onto trucks or onto trains.
Yep.
And it imposes costs on a lot of people. And of course, not every place is able to bear those costs. So in some ways, this trend towards larger ships is solidifying the position of these very large ports, which may or may not be in the right place from the perspective of where those goods eventually need to go. So you might actually increase the amount of travel just to then transship them somewhere else. And of course, from an equity perspective, a lot of places in the global south, in Africa, Southeast Asia, or Latin America might not be in the position of attracting that kind of trade, and therefore not getting the economic benefit from that trade. So it's an inefficient system. It's an inequitable system. And it also has to do with the kind of power dynamics in a sector where you have a very few big players who are able to exert that kind of market power.
I guess what also is an issue here is the fact that it's global. So it's so many governments would need to agree with each other to really get something globally organized. What's happening in that part of the equation?
Well, there is the International Maritime Organization, the IMO, which is the global shipping regulator. And as you say, it's when you've got that many country parties from around the world having to negotiate and discuss, it moves slowly. It's not easy. But I think a lot of sectors would be envious of actually having a place to have this conversation, because there are, whether it's cement or steel or whatever else, we don't really have a single place to talk about safety, to talk about environment. And so the IMO has been, let's say, trailing behind leading areas of the world that have moved forward with its policy, but then is able to create policies that cover every place in the world because it is an actual regulator. So it's kind of this game between, the European Union might go ahead with incorporating shipping into its emissions trading system, and then the IMO comes back and says, we're going to do something like that, but it's going to be applied globally. So this is a good, I would say, good interplay of leadership between international and national and regional policy. And they're just about to negotiate a series of measures over the coming 2 years, which will cover improvements to efficiency requirements, to a kind of fuel standard, and also a levy, carbon pricing, that is meant to enact a policy that they just agreed on this past summer in July, which is about the trajectory for decarbonizing the sector. So it's a really big moment in international agreement right now.
So what are the areas? And these can be, I'm talking legislation or technology or efficiency gains, or so what elements of these, all these decarbonization efforts do you like most? What are you most excited about?
Well, the way we think of it is that it's a puzzle where a lot of different things have to go together. As a foundation, shipping is not the most well-known sector in the world, and so we weren't able to attract a whole lot of philanthropic funding. And we started off working in the IMO because, like a lot of advocacy campaigns, you look for where you have the most leverage with the least money. So you think, well, they're the global regulator. But as I say, there's a kind of interplay between them and leadership, both in countries, but also within the industry. And so, we try to look at it as a series of puzzle pieces that have to be laid next to each other and hopefully will click together. The industry, I have to say that, to its credit, a lot of players in the shipping industry have got together over the years, created things like the Getting to Zero Coalition, which has already established a vision from within the industry about how they're going to decarbonize.
Yeah.
You have places like the EU or where I am in California that are quite forward thinking about their policy. But at the same time, you do need to be able to get the fuels developers there. You have to get the ports planning for the infrastructure. you have to get cargo owners, you know, your Amazons and IKEAs willing to pay to put their cargo on there, especially if it's going to cost a little bit more. And so we've been supporting initiatives that touch all of these things in, so that they can kind of combine and push things forward.
Could you highlight a few of these initiatives that you have supported?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I would start with something that is explicitly about pulling all of these elements together, which is a concept called green corridors. As I say, you know, if you're developing a fuel, will there be demand? If you're building a ship, will there be fuel? If you have a port, will there be ships? If you got cargo, you know, et cetera. So the idea behind green corridors is you get a port pair, let's say Rotterdam and Singapore, which are two of the biggest hubs in the world and certainly the two biggest refueling hubs. And they say, we're going to establish the conditions in which all of those pieces can come together. And it's just to kind of jumpstart the sector. And the thing about that is there are so many ships going between them on such long distances that they actually account for a pretty significant portion of the emissions. Yeah. If you add up big routes like that or going across the Pacific, Los Angeles and Shanghai have an agreement as well. So we've been supporting organizations working in a coalition that are, on the one side, kind of pushing from the outside, motivating them, saying, you've got to make agreements to do this. And then working in a cooperative way to say, well, what does it look like to actually implement that? And how are we going to establish those agreements? And we're hopeful that in the next couple of years, the green corridors will go from that conceptual stage to seeing contracts in place and really giving the conditions necessary to see them come about. In addition to that, we are, of course, looking at this process in the IMO over the next couple of years, and organizations we've been working with in the IMO for many years are gearing up to provide technical analysis and advice and motivation so that we have a carbon price, which will actually be able to not only account to some degree for the economic externalities, environmental externalities imposed by ship fuel, but also raise money, which can be to some measure reinvested in the sector, and in particular in those countries where, let's say that they are far-flung countries, less developed, that really rely on their shipping industry. And this is true also for like small island states, which for obvious reasons really rely on shipping. They can get some reinvestment that will help them be part of this process as well. And a fuel standard, which is going to help really kind of define the trajectory. As I say, there's so many options with fuels. It can get a little bit confusing, and it can also be hard to organize the confidence behind which solutions different investors want to go for. So if you establish a standard, you at least hopefully cut off the tendency to hang on too long to something that isn't really helping very much, but was convenient at the time.
Yeah, that makes sense. So so if I would ask you to just look ahead, what's around the corner for decarbonization in shipping? What are the big things that listeners of the podcast need to keep an eye on?
The development of the engines, the fuels, the ships, that's really just about to come to fruition. So the ideas that this whole sector has had are about to be realized. And so we're going to see these ships on the water. And that will mean that we'll be able to see if the green corridor concept really pulls together, if fuel developers and those that are demanding the fuels are actually going to kind of match up in supply and demand. And over the next couple of years, we'll see these ships on the water. We'll be able to get operational data from them, make sure that they're operated safely and in an environmentally friendly way. And I think we'll also importantly start to go from, you know, that area where we're kind of estimating fuel costs and guessing at what it would really be to seeing those prices start to come into a real market range. And that'll give more confidence to the sector. And of course, we're going to see these policies come into place. And you know, when we interact with the industry, we're often, for example, at the Global Maritime Forum, which is a group of players in the industry across the value chain who work together on moving the sector forward toward, among other things, decarbonization. they're aware that this is happening, that over the next 2 years, there will be IMO policies, et cetera. But I don't know it's widely understood within this sector that this transformation is going to happen. It's the global regulator has a strategy and they're going to implement policy. And these changes will be driven in one way or the other. There are countries, there's two pieces of legislation in the United States right now in Congress that is under consideration. The implementation of the EU's policy under Fit for 55 is coming into play. So there's a lot of things that are just about to kind of come together that it really will drive change. And so people who are involved in this sector need to be prepared and hopefully also, you know, be leading from the front as well.
Well, Jason, I'd like to thank you for sharing your knowledge and updating the Does Logistics Matter listeners on the current state of the decarbonization in shipping. It's a very important subject, and I think I should say thank you for the work you guys are doing in essentially saving the planet.
Well, doing our little piece of it, but it's been great talking to you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Does Logistics Matter? For more on trends and innovation in supply chain and logistics, visit our blog at logisticsmatter.com. If you want to be a guest on this podcast, please send an email to podcast@logisticsmatter.com. This podcast was produced by Dimitri Vleugel. The music is based on a sample by Ruggerman and produced by Michael Spengler. This episode was powered by ClimateWorks. ClimateWorks is a global platform for philanthropy to innovate and scale high-impact climate solutions that benefit people and the planet. They deliver global programs and services that equip philanthropy with the knowledge, networks, and solutions to drive climate progress for a more sustainable and equitable future. For more information, visit climateworks.org.